Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Latin American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Lizeth Baron Carvajal, a host of the channel. Here at the NBN, we know that the world is facing a tremendous challenge and that many of you are dealing to the best of your abilities with the consequences of this pandemic. We hope that in the midst of all, these interviews can help you face the dread and isolation, or at the very least, that they can distract you and help you think in something else. This is why today, I will be talking to Paulo Rinat about his wonderful book, The Sexual Question, A History of Prostitution in Peru, 1850s-1950s, published by Cambridge University Press in 2020. Welcome, Paulo. Thank you for talking to me, especially in this moment.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so I'm so happy to have you here. I love this book. But before we talked about the book, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about your history. So you're an associate professor of Latin American history at the University College London. So it's the first time I interview someone that is in Europe. So you pursued your undergraduate and graduate degrees in the UK. You started by studying economic history, but then you move on to focus more specifically on Latin American history, or more generally, let's put it like that. So tell us a little bit about the path that led you here, and why you eventually became interested in history.
Sure. So I suppose a place to start is that I was born in Peru to Peruvian parents, but spent most of my childhood in Europe, first in France and then in the UK. But I grew up in a very kind of Peruvian household with left-wing politics, and Peru was very much at the center of everything that went on in the family. So when I went to university, I guess my goal, like perhaps a lot of kids who grew up in left-wing families, was to change the world. So I studied economics for one term and realized that the economics that I was being taught wasn't going to change the world. It was going to make someone a lot of money somewhere, but it wasn't going to do anything that was of interest to me. So I switched to economic history, which was a lot closer to the kind of interest that I had at the time. And then I went to Oxford to do my graduate studies. I was drawn there ostensibly because Rosemary Thorpe, who is an economic historian of Peru, was based there at the time, and I was interested to work with her. And then when I was in Oxford, I became more interested in social history, political history, and I ended up working with Alan Knight, historian of Mexico. So that's the sort of personal academic trajectory. I was lucky to grow up in an environment where there was a lot of intellectual discussion. And a very close friend of my parents is the Peruvian historian Nelson Manrique. And so through those personal connections, I suppose I got interested in history quite early on. But my training really came at university.
Great. That explains too much. And it probably explains the next question I'm going to make. So The Sexual Question is not your first book. So you have another monograph titled The Allure of Labor, Workers' Race, and the Making of the Peruvian State. This was published in 2011. You've also been editor and co-editor of many other volumes. I believe one or a couple of them with Alan Knight. So, and you cover a very diverse set of topics: comic books, the Great Depression in Latin America, Che Guevara's travels. So, among many other different topics. So, this is a very impressive record of publication. And I noticed that you have published almost of all of your work, both in English and Spanish. So, I would love for you to tell our listeners how you came to the topic of this book in particular. It seems by your introduction that a lot had to do with archival serendipity, but I guess in a more general sense, I would like for you to tell us how you move between such varied topics, different languages, and different audiences as well. Do you have a preferred language with which you usually write, or does that depend on the project? Do you find it at all difficult to go back and forth between languages? I certainly struggle with that. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So, I mean, I think my academic language is definitely English. I'm fluent in French and Spanish, but I find it harder to write, you know, academic stuff in those languages. And, you know, for career purposes, my strategy has always been to publish in English whenever possible, because that's what, you know, the sort of career demands. But I've also tried to make sure that whatever I publish in English is also available in Spanish, because I want to, you know, establish a dialogue with readers in Peru in particular, but in Latin America more generally. So that's really my kind of language strategy or policy, if you want to call it that. You know, because I've trained in British universities, I'm more comfortable in writing in English, but I have written in Spanish and French, though I usually, you know, ask someone to go over the style and so forth. And as to the topics, so my PhD dissertation focused on the 1920s and 1930s in Peru. It was a kind of a labor history project, and after I completed the dissertation in 2000, I sort of left the dissertation to one side. I didn't touch it for a few years, focused on other things that I got interested in. I was lucky that the sort of jobs I got allowed me to do that. I wrote an article on the history of suicide in early 20th century Peru. I put together a group of people for an edited volume on Che Guevara's early travels. Arising from my dissertation work, I did a project on the Great Depression that Alan Knight co-edited with me. These were all topics that in some ways are related to each other, but that grew out of just my interests, I suppose. And then I went back to my dissertation around 2005, 2006, and it took me a few years to write it up as an academic monograph. And in the end, the book I published in 2011 is very different to the dissertation. Maybe there's about, I don't know, 20% of the dissertation left in the book. And it changed in approach, and I did a lot more work on it. And it ended up as less history of labor, though labor is very much at the center of it, and more a history of the making of the Peruvian state and the role of race and racialization in that process. So that's a little bit the trajectory that then got me to this new book, The Sexual Question. And as I mentioned in the introduction, I got into this topic because of the sources that I was looking at. I was reading police reports that focus primarily on anarchists and members of APRA and so forth. And I started to find some letters written by women who self-identified as prostitutes. These were letters that were sent to the prefect of Lima. And I knew that these sources were rare. I'd read a few books on the history of prostitution, and you know what is often missing in those books is the voices of women who sold sex, if you like. So I made some notes and the project sort of grew out of that.
Yeah, wonderful. And it's such a, I don't know, a good thing to hear, because I feel like when I'm in the archive, sometimes I also have like sources that I find interesting that are not strictly related to my project. And then I wonder if I should pay attention to them or not. So it's great to hear like that this can be so useful for the in the long run. So I guess now we can move to the book. And here, I think a good way to introduce the book to our listeners is if you talk a little bit about the sexual question, right? What is the sexual question? So you tell us that the sexual question refers to the sexual issues that stood in the way of the flourishing of population and the solutions that were devised to address such problems. So why do you use prostitution specifically as a vehicle to analyze this problem? Because I guess there are other ways to do that too. But why is it useful to shed light into this problem you are analyzing in the book? And here I think it can be useful if you talk about the importance of Foucault in your work. I think scholars that focus on the late 19th century and early 20th century find in Foucault a great tool and resource. But as you tell us in the book, even if you are inspired by Foucault, you, alongside other scholars such as Rita Felski, you argued that what is missing in Foucault is a more careful examination of the agents that intervene in the story, and you want to do that, and you actually do that very well. So can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, so the title and this term, if you like, the sexual question, was something I came up with, and this sort of relates back to my first project, my first book, which was ostensibly on the social question in late 19th and early 20th century Peru. So if the social question were, you know, those series of issues that industrialization and urbanization created, and particularly in relation to the rise of the labor movement in Europe, and also refers to the series of policies, measures that governments introduced to address labor militancy or, you know, urban unrest and things like that. With sexual question, I was trying to find a concept that captured an analogous process, if you like, that is to say how problems associated with the sexual came to be seen as problems, right? Or issues that were associated with the sexual came to be seen as problems, problems that required solutions, and then I looked also at what those solutions were, how they were formulated and implemented. So that's what the sexual question refers to. And in fact, there is a book by a French sexologist, Auguste Forel, from the 1890s, titled The Sexual Question. Though I didn't know this when I came up with the concept to organize my thoughts, but I think it's quite telling that, you know, Forel had come up with the same concept over 100 years ago to refer to a very similar way of approaching this issue. So Foucault, of course, is influential in all of this because of his work on the history of sexuality. But in fact, I relied on Foucault a great deal more in my first book. In that book, I drew on his idea of governmentality a lot to make sense of the way that the Peruvian state came to deal with the labor question. In this book, obviously, I draw on Foucault and, you know, all the work that has been influenced by his insights on, you know, the kind of discursive construction of sexuality, how sexuality becomes part of strategies of discipline, how sexuality becomes central to a kind of biopolitical project. But in the end, I think I spend more time showing that all of this is sort of limited or constrained by multiple agencies, the agencies of, you know, the women who sold sex in early 20th century Peru. And although I do this less successfully, also the agency of the men who bought the sex from those women. So, yeah, I suppose Foucault is there, but in that tweaked way by paying attention to the actors that often, you know, are neglected in very kind of Foucauldian readings of the history of sexuality.
Yeah, no, and I think this is a great way to see how Foucault can be useful for historians, but to see how paying real attention to very specific historical processes actually show the limitations of Foucault, which is, you know, also useful. Okay, so let's move on to, let's say, the more specific intervention in your book, what your book is doing. So you focus specifically on prostitution and venereal disease and their government. So in particular about how ideas about male and female sexuality informed attempts to govern prostitution and venereal disease. You ask why regulation of prostitution was adopted in Peru in the 1920s, and then why it was seemingly abandoned in the 1950s. So here the creation and then the closure of La Victoria, Lima's Barrio Rojo or Red Light District is essential. And this is how you start your introduction. So I think it would be useful for our listeners if you situate Lima's case in a comparative perspective, as you do in the book, because regulation was, as you explain, a fairly common strategy, but one that in many countries in the world, in Latin America as well, was implemented in the second half of the 19th century, so not in the early 20th century. So this strategy of regulation, you tell us, contributed to two developments that characterized the so-called medicalization of Latin American societies. One was the pathologization of societies, and the other was the possibility of regeneration and quote-unquote civilization. So tell us more about these linked aspects of medicalization, and maybe here you can tell us why Lima was, to say it in a way, late in this global history of prostitution?
Yeah. So I think maybe to start, it would be useful to explain how regulation emerges as a paradigm to manage or govern prostitution, and also to place it alongside the other paradigm, the other dominant paradigm in the 19th and 20th centuries, which is called abolition. So regulation, although, you know, in some ways it has a much older history, going back to, well, as far back as you can, perhaps, you know, was a system of policies that come to be associated primarily with early 19th century France does in relation to urban prostitution primarily, which, you know, is a series of measures such as the creation of red light districts, so places where within cities where prostitution is permitted, policies to kind of medically police prostitutes, so regular medical inspections, registration of prostitutes with the police or some type of authority, and, you know, regulations establishing what can happen in brothels and what can't, and so forth. So these are the kinds of policies associated with regulation, that they tend to be associated primarily with the French model, and then they're adopted elsewhere in Europe and in European colonies around the world, and indeed in Latin America and the United States at different times. Together with regulation, another kind of paradigm emerges in the mid-19th century, just comes to be known as abolition, and this is basically a critique of regulation. And I mean, basic argument is that regulation doesn't achieve what it sets out to do, which is to control the moral impact of prostitution, but even more so the public health impact because of this association between prostitution and the spread of venereal disease, particularly syphilis. And so those who support abolition are against the implementation of regulation. And here, the most famous case is that of the campaigns led against the implementation of regulation in garrison towns in England in the second half of the 19th century. So these are the two kind of paradigms, and the history of prostitution and its government in Peru is really a history of these two paradigms and how they you know, they play off each other, how different actors align on one side or the other at different times. And the story I tell is one of how regulation, after, you know, not being very successful in establishing itself as the dominant paradigm in the 19th century, eventually succeeds in a limited way, because really it's only implemented in Lima, not much beyond it. And then how by the 1950s, abolitionist positions gain much more currency, and the, you know, the chief achievement of the regulationists, which was the establishment of Lima's red light district in La Victoria, this district of Lima, is closed down. Now, in practice, the closing down of the red light district doesn't really signal the end of regulation, because, as I mentioned in the conclusion to the book, in a way, Peru still has a kind of regulationist system, in that you can still obtain a license to run a brothel, and there are official regulated brothels still today in Lima. But the closure of the red light district, I think, does signal a major victory for the abolitionist cause, because of the extent to which the red light district was associated with regulation. So that takes me back to your question about medicalization. And yes, I mean, I see the implementation of regulation in the context of this process whereby Latin American societies come to be understood in, you know, through this sort of medicalized gaze as societies that are diseased or ill, and that need to be brought back to health through the actions of medical doctors and other experts. And so in that process, you know, you have these two moments or aspects. One is the a kind of diagnosis of pathology. You know, these are societies that are ill or sick and that need attention, but also the idea that one can, through, you know, the implementation of the correct measures, bring the patient back to health, right? So this is the regeneration element. And this is, of course, a discourse in which a whole series of expert actors, from medical doctors to lawyers to increasingly in the 20th century social scientists, they all participate in this twin process of, you know, diagnosing disease and devising or proposing solutions. So why did regulation come late to Lima? To be honest, I don't think I provide a very satisfactory answer to this in the book. I mean, I do show that it came late, because certainly compared to, say, Cuba, Mexico, Argentina, where regulation is introduced much earlier, the introduction of regulation in Peru comes later. And I show in the first chapter that, you know, there were a whole series of proposals put forward by medical doctors and by others in the 19th century to introduce a system of regulation very much on the French model. And I also showed that there was resistance from a series of actors, the church, conservative sectors, even an interesting character that I talk about, the agente fiscal or Attorney General Manuel Galvez, who takes a very clearly abolitionist position in rejecting proposals put forward for regulation in the 1880s. But why exactly in the early 20th century regulation eventually triumphs, I can't pinpoint it, but we do see, you know, by 1905, a decree, which is called the Decree of Police Licenses and Fines, which ostensibly creates a legal framework for regulation that follows very much the French model I described before. So it establishes where brothels can operate, who can work in the brothel, what kind of licenses need to be paid by the brothel owner, by women working in the brothel, things like, you know, what time the brothel must stop the music, if there's any music, that forbids the selling of alcohol. et cetera, et cetera. So why it comes late, the answer I can come to this is because there's a lot of opposition, but of course there was opposition elsewhere too. So whether there was more in Peru than in other countries is not entirely clear to me. But certainly by the early 20th century, we see it. It's there. There's a system for it. At the same time, it's implemented very slowly, haltingly. It's not a system that has a before and an after. It comes into existence in a very unclear way, at least as far as I can establish from the archive.
Yeah, and I think this is why it's so useful that you situate your work globally, but also you're very clear that the Peru has very specific historical conditions. So there's no set script, right, in this history of prostitution. And you're showing us both the global influences, the global debate that's going on around, but also the specific historical circumstances of Peru that explain why certain things happen in certain moments and not in others. But you're not interested solely to talk to scholars that have written about prostitution, even if that is an important part of your project. You're also interested in other sets of literatures. You, for example, also situate your work within the global history of sexual science and also the history of the state in Peru and Latin America. So this last, like the history of the state, makes sense because you told us your first project was clearly situated within this literature. So I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about these historiographical debates or dialogues, as you call them. Mm-hmm. I am a historian of medicine, so I wonder if when you began this project, you knew that this literature was going to be so important, or did this happen as you were like working on the project? And because many of the articles you quote about global history of science in Latin America, I think came in the 2000s, 2010s. So I wonder if this was organically developed as you were working on the project, or if you knew when you started that this was going to be a very important part of the project.
Right. I mean, I had read a few classic studies like, Wolkowitz's work on Victorian England and of course, Donna Guy's, seminal study of prostitution in Argentina. And so I had some idea of what a study of the history of prostitution might look like. But really, the research was very kind of inductive, led by the sort of sources that I came across in the archive, which, as I mentioned before, were ostensibly, police correspondence or correspondence with the police, very often letters written by prostitutes, or even more so by vecinos, or neighbors who were complaining about the brothels in their streets and things like that. So those were the sources that got me interested in the project. And obviously, when I decided that I would continue with this, I had to go beyond those sources. So one area that proved very fruitful, one type of source that became very fruitful were medical journals, because obviously doctors were very concerned with venereal disease in this period, and so that brought them to talk also about prostitution and regulation and so forth. Although, as I show in the book, their focus on prostitutes is very much a product of history. I mean, by the 1930s, they're starting to realize that actually the main vector of venereal disease contagion are not prostitutes, but rather, just young people who are having unprotected sex. But certainly in the late 19th century, early 20th century, most doctors who are writing about venereal disease are also writing about prostitution. So I found a lot of material there in medical journals and medical theses, and I use them a great deal in the book. So yes, I mean, I established these dialogues with, I guess, three broad fields: the history of gender and sexuality, the history of medicine and public health and the history of the state. You know, it's the sort of topic that forces you to branch out into these broader fields or subfields, because it's very much at the intersection of the three. And I try to read as broadly as possible, not just on Latin America, but, you know, on Europe, Africa, Asia. There's such a rich historiography on the history of prostitution, on the history of venereal disease. And in a sense, you know, it's a bit silly to put it this way, but the book on Peru was missing, right? There are great books on the history of prostitution in Mexico, in Cuba, in Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, and there were some studies on the history of prostitution in Peru, including a very good anthropological study by Lorraine Nensel, which focused primarily on ethnography of sex workers in the 1990s, but which includes a very detailed account of the historical development of prostitution and regulation. But there was no kind of archive-based study. That's where I thought my contribution could be.
Yeah, definitely. And this book, I think, it can be useful for many different scholars, audiences. So it's not just for people interested in Peru or South America or Latin America, but also for students, professors interested in gender and sexuality, the history of the state, public health and medicine, and also, as we're going to talk about a little bit later, about race, because race also comes in your story, and it has a an important role as well.
Yeah.
I think we've covered some of the basics. So I would like us to move to the chapters you divided the book in six chapters that move more or less chronologically, or sometimes there's a little bit overlap between them. But I think we can skip chapter one, which is titled Regulating Prostitution, which is where you examine the debates over the regulation of prostitution that took place in the 19th century. A little bit because you have talked about this before, and also because I think the heart of your book is located in the next chapters. So if our listeners are interested in this debate around regulation in the late 19th century, they can go to that chapter. But I think we should talk about chapters two and three together. So in chapter two, which is titled Protecting Men, you tell us how the implementation of regulation in Lima took place in the first decades of the 20th century. And I mean, even if you say you couldn't quite pinpoint why regulation happened in this particular moment, you do kind of situate this process in very specific historical circumstances. So you also tell us that regulation of prostitution was devised as a mean to protect men, and certain men, to be more precise. So it wasn't a strategy to protect women, right? And this is tightly close to chapter three, which is titled Policing Women. And here you discuss the context in which Lima's Barrio Rojo, or Red Light District, was established in 1928. So tell us why reformers came to see regulation of prostitution as, I don't know if I call it this double-edged sword that meant protecting certain men and policing women. Here, I was super interested in how men are seen as victims while women are considered like the vectors of disease. So they're not seen as victims, right? Well, I mean, sexual workers. And what is the role of race in this process? Because I was really intrigued by the fact that in this period, authorities shut down brothels that catered to Afro-Peruvian men, while they allowed the proliferation of brothels that serve upper and middle classes. So tell us a little bit about this particular moment so central to your book and the role of race and racial ideas.
Yeah, I mean, so perhaps the place to start is with this sort of basic idea at the heart of the regulationist paradigm, which is that, you know, if men need sex, right? And if men cannot access sex, bad things will happen. And so prostitution, you know, I mean, not just in the 19th century, but even before that, was often thought of as a kind of sexual safety valve for men, right? If men could not satisfy their sexual needs in the context of marriage, then prostitutes offered an important service to men where their, I guess you could call it maybe their excess sexual desire could be satisfied. So for regulationists, I mean, the way that they framed this was that, you know, men needed sex. If they didn't get it from prostitutes, they would get it in other ways, which were worse from point of view of their social outcomes, if you like. And so it made sense to help men access sex, even if it meant that they paid for it, and make sure that the sex that they accessed in brothels was not going to make them sick, was not going to give them a venereal disease, etc. So regulation was, you know, partly about making sure that men's sexual desires were met and that in doing so, worse outcomes were prevented, but also about making sure that when men accessed sex in brothels, they did so in a way that did not harm them. So this is really why regulation, as I understand it, was ostensibly about protecting men and their access to sex. And at the heart of this is this notion that the philosopher Amyas Srinivasan has called the right to sex, right, which is a sort of debate that is very contemporary in some ways. So yeah, there are those two aspects. And the reason that men's access to sex needed to be protected was that if men became ill because of venereal disease, they would then pass it on to their families. And generally, you know, this would kind of undermine the vitality of the male population, but also the population as a whole in a context in which, you know, as we discussed earlier, the medicalization of society required governments to oversee the health of the population. At the same time, in chapter three, I look at how regulation also implied the kind of policing of female sexuality. What you see is that at the same time that the system of regulation established a series of brothels where men could go, and so it was believed they could access sex in a safe way, it was imperative that this system of regulation did not create a kind of moral context that was harmful to women. Women who were not considered prostitutes needed to be shielded from this world of prostitution. So it was imperative that brothel prostitution took place in certain parts of the city, certain places within the city that, you know, removed them from the gaze of women, children, women and children. So a lot of the regulations have to do with where brothels can be located. And what I argue in the chapter is that underpinning this logic was the fear that the sexuality of prostitutes might trigger a similar type of sexuality in women in general, right? And so I look at the ways that the figure of the sort of the liberated woman of the 1920s, which is kind of associated with the flapper, or as she was known in Peru, la mujer muchacho, how that figure in a lot of the discourse of the time is very much associated with the prostitute, right? That there is a very clear, in my mind at least, a clear conflation of the flapper and the prostitute. And I see this as a critique of women who were kind of claiming a greater say in social and political life, but also as a way of kind of policing a female sexuality, which was understood to be transgressive and dangerous. And the way in which it was policed was by kind of associating it with the sexuality of the prostitute. Sorry, and I didn't touch on the question of Afro-Peruvian men. So this is really a story of what happens when regulation is established. And what you see is that the police, which is given the power to open and or allow the opening and then closing brothels, uses this power to kind of shape the geography of prostitution in Lima. And in particular, they target very clearly brothels that were located in areas of the city, particularly on the other side of the Rímac River, in a part of Lima called the Rímac or Abajo el Puente, which was an area of Lima with a large Afro-Peruvian population. And the brothels there, which, you know, were brothels, but they were also, you know, kind of drinking places and so forth, are perceived by the authorities as particularly dangerous, as places where the capacity of the state to ensure that, you know, the non-contagion of venereal diseases is guaranteed cannot happen because of the type of clientele, the type of women who work there, etc. And so there is this very differentiated treatment of brothels run by Afro-Peruvian women and men who which cater for primarily Afro-Peruvian clienteles, and then other brothels, which we see a kind of a proliferation of it in this period, which come to be associated with the immigration of European prostitutes. So a phenomenon that, you know, other historians have looked at, particularly in Buenos Aires, but also in other cities in Latin America in the 19-teens and 20s, when European prostitutes find their way to Latin America in the wake of the First World War. And in Lima, too, you see, and you can find this in immigration records, a number of women who come to Lima to set up brothels. And these brothels are sort of encouraged by the police. They're seen as the sort of brothels that are consonant with their strategy, whereas the Afro-Peruvian ones are clearly not.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I think in this answer, you kind of show us the breadth of your approach, right? You're touching so many different topics and you do that so naturally. It's quite remarkable. And for our listeners, if they're interested in any of these things, I believe they should go and read the book because it's wonderful. Now let's move to chapters 4 and 5, which are titled Medicalizing Sin and Combating Venereal Disease. Here you analyze the development of institutional capacities for the treatment of venereal disease. So you focus on a shift in discourse that occurred in the 1920s and 30s. So while prior to this period, as we've talked, medical doctors believed that policing prostitutes was the principal method to control the spread of venereal disease, in the 20s and 30s, there was a shift in strategies, and now sex education and the expansion of treatment facilities were the preferred methods for regulation. So why did this change occur? And why did the expansion of treatment centers coincide with a preoccupation among doctors about venereal disease in Peru's indigenous population?
Right. So in essence, I mean, what you start to see is that the biomedical establishment that deals with venereal disease grows in the 19-teens, 20s. There's an institution called the Asistencia Pública, which is created in 1911 to essentially implement the policy of regulation. And over the course of the 20s and 30s, it expands in capacity. It's underfunded, etc., but it starts to gain some degree of capacity to oversee the management of prostitution and venereal disease in Lima, and it starts to collect data. It has a better kind of it increases, if you like, the cognitive capacity of the state vis-a-vis venereal disease and prostitution. And here the role of its chief in the 1930s, Victor Eguiguren, is particularly important. He kind of is an important, if largely unknown, doctor who takes over the Asistencia Pública in the early 30s and goes on to really kind of expand its reach, not only in Lima, but also to the rest of Peru. And he starts to look at the data and he sort of realizes that, as I mentioned before, most venereal disease infections are not occurring as a consequence of men purchasing sex from prostitutes, but rather, as we might say today, in the community, right? And so this shifts the strategy from merely policing prostitutes and making sure that the prostitutes are undergoing their medical examinations. You know, by this time, actually, it was pretty clear to doctors that subjecting prostitutes to medical examinations once a week did very little to control the spread of venereal disease. And the treatments that were available, even after, you know, new drugs come on the scene, like salvarsan in the 19-teens, they did very little to either control the spread or cure those who were infected, particularly by syphilis. So other types of strategies need to be devised. And the one that Egiguren in particular favors is sex education, right? So, you know, he kind of implements a whole series of measures, lectures, the showing of films in schools, in factories and so forth. And a lot of these methods he kind of borrows from what military doctors had started to do a few years earlier. For military doctors, it was very important to make sure that, you know, their troops were healthy and free from venereal disease. And they were very concerned that the soldiers and the sailors had very high levels of venereal disease infection. And so they had begun to promote sex education in barracks and so forth. And at the same time, Egiguren, at the same time as he's kind of promoting this strategy of sex education, he is strengthening the capacity to offer treatment. Now, treatment at the time, as I said, was not particularly effective. It was extremely painful. There was still quite a lot of dependence on use of arsenic and so forth, even in the salvarsan era. You know, I mean, salvarsan was seen as a kind of magic bullet that would solve the problem of venereal disease of syphilis. In the end, it didn't prove as effective as it was originally hoped. And it's only really with, you know, the sort of the period of antibiotics that you start to see a real change in the effectiveness of treatment of venereal disease. But nevertheless, the capacity to treat venereal disease patients increases significantly in this period, with more and more treatment centers established in Lima and elsewhere. And by the 1940s, there's a sort of a national venereal disease program, which is present in most major Peruvian cities. And as you indicated in your question, this coincides with a growing attention among medical doctors to the indigenous population in Peru. And I look at this because I was particularly interested in the many ways in which the debates about venereal disease are highly racialized in the Peruvian context. And you see it first in the late 19th century and early 20th century in the ways that Asian immigrants, and particularly Chinese immigrants to Peru, they are stigmatized in many ways, accused of introducing all kinds of diseases into Peru, in particular bubonic plague, and Marcos Cueto has researched that very effectively. But they are also blamed for the high levels of infection of syphilis and in very kind of racialized discourses at that time. But by the 1930s and 40s, that the focus, this kind of racialized reading of venereal disease shifts focus to the indigenous population, which is seen as either very vulnerable to venereal disease because they are understood to be kind of sexual innocents, or as a real threat because of their high propensity to sexual immorality, and therefore, the likelihood that they will become infectious and infect everyone else. So I devote a significant part of chapter 5 to this question, to how medical doctors in particular, but others also, start to discuss venereal disease in the context of indigenous populations and how they racialize that discussion in very overt ways.
Yeah, and I think particularly in this moment, this discussion about the racialization of disease epidemics is so important because what we are living, what we've been discussing in the last week. So I think listeners that also have those preoccupations today can find in your book a very interesting historical example. So, we arrive to chapter 6, which is the last chapter. And this chapter is titled Abolishing Bias. So here, as the title suggests, you analyze the closure of Lima's red light district in 1956. So you tell us that abolitionism brought doctors, lawyers, and feminists who criticized regulation on medical and moral terms. So the movement criticized regulation by challenging assumptions about male sexuality, in particular the double standard, and also by arguing that the state promoted a lax sexuality. Though the movement embraced feminist arguments, abolitionists were guided by very conservative sexual mores, and they tried to define sexuality as exclusively linked to procreative ends. So you tell us that, I mean, you've told us already that abolitionism has existed for a long time, but in the case of Peru, it was influential in the 1930s, but it really took hold in the late 1940s and 1950s. So why was abolitionism successful in this moment and not before? And I'm very intrigued about the role of feminists in this story, because as you tell us, they participated in a very conservative movement that at the end had very traditional ideas about female sexuality, sexual roles. So I want us to finish with this last chapter, you telling us a little bit more about this.
Yeah, so what I show in this chapter is that by 1956, when the red light district is closed, the idea that, you know, a red light district in Lima could contribute to governing venereal disease was very difficult to sustain, right? There were few people there were still people who supported regulation, but it was difficult for them to make the argument that the red light district was contributing to a kind of public health initiative. And by contrast, those who were very critical of regulation could point to the red light district as evidence of the failure of regulation. And so, you know, the emphasis of abolitionists was very much on shutting down the red light district as the sort of the symbol of regulationist policy. And they proved quite successful in influencing public opinion through, you know, this was a period when you start to see the kind of proliferation of like a more popular press, more kind of a yellow press, if you like, populist press even, and which was more willing than sort of the traditional press to take up issues like prostitution and venereal disease and even put them on their front pages. And so these there were a number of newspapers of this kind in this period that take up the campaign against the red light district and prove quite effective in, you know, influencing public opinion, but particularly influencing the opinion of those who were in a position to shut it down, so municipal authorities, prefect, and so forth. And what's interesting is that in the group of people who are kind of pushing this agenda, you find this mix of lawyers and doctors and some feminists, and actually feminists who are also lawyers and who are also doctors. And in particular, one woman who I found very interesting, a lawyer called Susana Solano, who plays a very important role in the abolitionist campaign, who was also a key figure in the Peruvian eugenics movement, and, you know, who is as you said, he's a campaigner against, you know, what she sees as the double standard, right? And so, like a lot of feminists in the early 20th century, she was very critical of the fact that, you know, men were held to a standard of sexual behavior that was different to that of women. She didn't agree with the idea that men had sexual needs that needed to be met, because, you know, not meeting them would create more problems. She was very much in favor of abstinence and, you know, and sexual responsibility, if you like. And of course, she was also in favor of kind of first wave feminist issues like more jobs for women. She viewed prostitution, actually, like a lot of regulationists did also, as something that happened because women had no access to employment. So her critique was, you know, it was there was a sort of social and political critique there of a society that didn't create opportunities for women in employment, in education, and so forth. There was a critique also of what she saw as irresponsible male sexual behavior, but she did not kind of set out to challenge traditional gender roles, as it were, and still saw, you know, sexuality as something that should be channeled towards, you know, procreative ends. So in some ways, she wasn't in favor of sexual freedom or anything like that. And there were other feminists like her earlier in the period that I've just been talking about that took quite similar positions. That said, there were other feminists who were more radical, if you like. So this wasn't the only position within the Peruvian feminist movement, to the extent that there was one, but it proved influential in shaping, you know, how abolitionism viewed the role of women in a kind of post-regulation period.
Yeah, and I think here you show us how you also contribute to a literature that, even if this is not your focus, but how this literature that shows that feminism, feminist movement, feminist women were also participants of conservative movements, eugenics. So this is also an invitation for listeners interested in those topics. So we have discussed a lot of aspects of your book, and I've taken too much of your time already. But I like to finish these interviews by asking you how you think your book speaks to the present. And your conclusion actually does that. You tell us why this history is still very present in Peru today. But I just wonder if there's anything you want to tell us, whether about the conclusion or something else that you've come to think about how your book, this history matters for what is happening today.
Well, you know, I think that what I point to in the conclusion are certain continuities, right? In particularly in how, I guess, prostitution is talked about in Peru, the sort of assumptions that guide current discussions on sex work. And also, I guess, just generally, you know, perhaps this is somewhat banal, but that, you know, prostitution, the history of prostitution is a bit like a mirror on which we can see society reflected. And so, you know, studying the history of prostitution seems to me, at least this was my experience, got me thinking about lots of things that can help us understand the history of Peru a bit better. Hopefully others who read the book will agree with that.
I agree. And I thought that conclusion was a very nice way to round up the discussion. So just to finish up, can you tell us what are you working on? I mean, you just published the book, so I'm sure your work now has to do with talking about this book. But what are you working on? What are your plans for the next couple of years?
Yes. So I've been working for a few years now with a colleague, Martin Bergel, of the Universidad de Quilmes in Argentina, on an edited volume on APRA, the Peruvian political party. And I'm starting to think about a new kind of book project, which would be a kind of a biography of José Carlos Mariátegui. That's the plan anyway. We'll see if that happens.
Awesome. I mean, I know Mariátegui is so important for Peruvian history, Latin American history as well. So I'm very looking forward to those projects. Thank you for talking to me. And this was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.